content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. Happy New Year, everyone. We are reading this week from the December 31st, 2013 edition of The Week magazine. And I'll start this week with a note to the readers. Welcome to a special year-end issue of The Week. For the first time, we have expanded on the year-end features that we used to squeeze into our last regular issue and given them their own home. We hope they'll provide some reading pleasure for our loyal subscribers in the lull between Christmas and New Year's. In this issue, we take you on a tour of the year in news and business. We select some of the best achievements in books, music, art, and food. We've also curated three great longer reads that we found in our exhaustive reading of newspapers, magazines, and websites. All of it, of course, is spiced with a bit of fun. At year's end, I want to express my gratitude to our 560,000 subscribers who've made this year the best year yet for The Week. In recent months, subscribers have given more than 100,000 gift subscriptions to friends and relatives. Thanks to your enthusiasm, our business is strong and growing at a time when many print and digital publications are struggling. It's both gratifying and humbling. We live in interesting times. In 2014, we'll continue to do our best to give you a succinct, intelligent, and lively summary of what's happening and what a wide variety of very smart people think about it all. My talented staff and I wish you, the extended family of The Week, a very happy new year. Signed, William Falk, Editor-in-Chief. P.S. To recharge our batteries, we are now taking some time off. Your next issue of The Week will be dated January 17th and should begin arriving on January 10th. And so with that note to the readers in mind, we'll spend the next 2 weeks working through this special edition of The Week magazine. And we'll start with the year in review. It's a month-by-month summary of what happened and what was reported on in this magazine through the year. January. The year begins with the federal government hurtling toward the fiscal cliff of tax hikes and mandated budget cuts that would gouge a hole in the fragile economy. Rather than reaching the hoped-for grand bargain on taxes and spending, Republicans and Democrats strike a messy short-term deal that raises revenue by closing loopholes in the tax code, while postponing the automatic budget cuts called the sequester. For just 2 months. In his second inaugural address, President Obama makes an unapologetic case for progressive government, pledging action on immigration reform, climate change, and gay rights. Safety net programs, including the health care reforms now universally known as Obamacare, do not make us a nation of takers, says Obama, in reference to GOP rhetoric from the recent presidential campaign. Preserving our individual freedoms ultimately requires collective action. Republicans vow to fight him every step of the way. February. In the Vatican, 85-year-old Pope Benedict XVI announces he'll retire at the end of the month due to his growing infirmity, becoming the first pope to step down voluntarily since since 1294. God told me to, Benedict later explains. President Obama uses his State of the Union speech to call for universal pre-kindergarten education, a hike in the minimum wage, and new gun regulation. The Republican response is delivered by rising GOP star Senator Marco Rubio, who suffers an untimely case of dry mouth, awkwardly reaches out of the TV frame, and slurps gratefully from a bottle of Poland Spring. Anti-war Republican Chuck Hagel becomes Obama's nominee for defense secretary, but barely survives his confirmation hearings, coming across as confused and defensive. Tea Party favorite Senator Ted Cruz manages to create sympathy for Hagel by demanding that he prove he has never taken money from North Korea. March. Last-minute negotiations between Republicans and Democrats fail, and the $85.4 billion in spending cuts mandated by the sequester takes effect on March 1st. The sky doesn't fall, but there are substantial cuts to defense spending, medical research, and the Head Start program, and thousands of government employees are furloughed. At the conclave in the Vatican, the cardinals elect Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina to be the new pope. He takes the name Francis. In Washington, Senator Rand Paul, another Tea Party favorite, grabs the spotlight with a 13-hour talking filibuster on the Senate floor, demanding assurances from Attorney General Eric Holder that the White House cannot order drone strikes against Americans on U.S. soil. North Korea renounces its 1953 armistice with South Korea. And state media release photos of young dictator Kim Jong-un planning missile strikes on a map of the U.S. Nonetheless, tattooed former NBA great Dennis Rodman undertakes a surreal one-man diplomatic mission to Pyongyang and describes his pal Kim as a cool guy who wears everyday regular clothes and likes music and sports and stuff. April. The Senate narrowly rejects a bill that would have expanded background checks for gun purchases, ending the final attempt to enact some form of gun control in response to the 2012 Newtown, Connecticut gun massacre. On April 15th, two homemade bombs explode at the finish line of the Boston Marathon, wounding hundreds of spectators, many grievously, and killing three people, including an 8-year-old boy. The suspects are quickly identified as brothers Tamerlan and Zokar Zarnev, 26 and 19 respectively, Muslim immigrants of Chechen descent who grew up in the Boston area. After a frantic manhunt shuts down Boston and its immediate suburbs, the elder Sarnaev is killed in a shootout with police, while a badly wounded Zokar is captured in a Watertown backyard where he'd been hiding in a covered boat. Sarnaev later explains that the bombings were a response to the killing of civilians in Iraq and Afghanistan and were intended to defend Islam from attack. May. As fighting in Syria enters its third year, forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad apparently use nerve gas against rebels. President Obama has previously called the use of chemical weapons a red line that would invite U.S. military intervention, but now seems hesitant to intervene. On the domestic front, Obama finds himself beset by a trio of scandals. Newly released emails breathe life into GOP charges that the White House participated in crafting talking points designed to minimize political embarrassment over the 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya. Meanwhile, the Justice Department admits it snooped on journalists' phone records while investigating leaks from the White House and the IRS admits that some officials gave intensive scrutiny to dozens of Tea Party-related and some liberal groups' applications for tax-exempt status. Americans are right to be angry about it, Obama says. I am angry about it. June. Iranian voters choose the centrist cleric Hassan Rouhani to replace the hardline Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as president. Rouhani thanks God that once again the sun of rationality and moderation is shining over Iran, raising hopes of a diplomatic solution to the ongoing standoff over Iran's uranium enrichment program. In Syria, Bashar al-Assad's forces appear to be gaining the upper hand, and President Obama finally authorizes the CIA to start supplying arms to the rebels. Americans are stunned when Edward Snowden, 29, a former government contractor, reveals that the National Security Agency has been keeping records of almost all U.S. phone activity for several years, while extensively spying on both phone calls and internet activity abroad. While Snowden takes refuge in Hong Kong, Obama defends surveillance as a vital safeguard of national security. You can't have 100% security and 100% privacy, says Obama. We're going to have to make some choices as a society. In a historic ruling, the Supreme Court strikes down the Defense of Marriage Act, thereby giving same-sex married couples full equality in the eyes of the federal government. July. Democrat Anthony Weiner, who resigned from Congress in 2011 amid a sexting scandal, announces his candidacy for New York City mayor and quickly rises to the top of the polls. In Florida, Neighborhood Watch volunteer George Zimmerman is acquitted of murdering unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin in 2012. The verdict sparks another wave of racial enmity, with white conservatives arguing that Zimmerman never should have been charged and blacks and liberals insisting that he got away with murder. In Britain, the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge welcome a son and name him George. Just weeks after it was launched, Weiner's mayoral campaign hits a large pothole when it's revealed that after his resignation from Congress, he continued his online sexting adventures, albeit now under the evocative pseudonym Carlos Danger. August. Government forces in Egypt gunned down hundreds of Muslim Brotherhood protesters demanding the return of ousted President Mohamed Morsi. In rebel-held suburbs of Damascus, Syria, at least 1,400 civilians die in a sarin gas attack. Assad denies any responsibility. In Washington, Republicans rally behind a new high-stakes effort to block Obamacare's rollout. Senators Cruz and Mike Lee join dozens of House Republicans in pledging to shut down the government, due to run out of money on October 1st, and vote against raising the federal debt ceiling unless Obama agrees to defund, or in effect repeal, the Affordable Care Act. Obama insists he will not submit to blackmail, but Tea Party Republicans are sure he will blink. At MTV's annual Video Music Awards, the nation watches in chagrin as former child star Miley Cyrus, 20, performs while sticking her tongue out lasciviously and simulating sex with a giant teddy bear and soul singer Robin Thicke. "You're wanting to make history," she later explains. September. As evidence mounts of Assad's involvement in the August 21st chemical attacks, President Obama seeks authorization from a skeptical Congress for airstrikes against Syria. At the last minute, however, an off-the-cuff comment from Secretary of State John Kerry about Syria surrendering its chemical weapons is seized on by Russian President Vladimir Putin and Assad himself. Negotiations quickly lead to a deal in which Assad agrees to hand over his chemical weapons to UN inspectors. As a result, Assad gets to remain in power, and Obama escapes a likely no vote by Congress on military action. In Nairobi, Kenya, gunmen from the Somalia-based Islamist group Al-Shabaab stormed the Westgate shopping mall, slaughtering 61 civilians before Kenyan commandos kill the hostage takers. In a Democratic primary, the liberal Bill de Blasio wins a landslide victory and becomes the likely successor to Republican Mayor Michael Bloomberg. Wiener finishes fifth. "I was an imperfect messenger," Wiener tells supporters, before fleeing the unexpected arrival of a provocatively dressed Sidney Leathers, 23, a former acquaintance from Twitter. October. Obama fails to blink, but House Republicans pass a spending bill that would delay the Affordable Care Act for a year, triggering the first government shutdown in 17 years. The uncertainty created by repeated Washington crises, said the nonpartisan macroeconomics advisors, has cut economic growth by 1% every year and added 1.4% to the unemployment rate. As the shutdown drags on, the GOP appears to have painted itself into a corner. "We have to get something out of this," says Representative Marlon Stutzman, Republican from Indiana, "and I don't know what that even is." Finally, as a mid-month deadline to raise the federal debt ceiling looms, stoking fears of a catastrophic default, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell strikes a deal with Senate Democrats on a bill that funds the government and raises the debt ceiling through the new year. As the government reopens, polls show that the public's views of both the Republican Party and Congress have sunk to record lows. But the Obama administration rescues the GOP with a disastrous launch of healthcare.gov web portal at the heart of the Affordable Care Act. The site provides access to the federal exchange supposed to help millions of Americans choose and enroll in insurance plans. It's full of bugs and crashes repeatedly. And on day one, the total number of Americans who manage to enroll is 6. November. As a tech surge of new administrators and IT professionals tries to repair the website, Obama's approval rating sinks to 37%, the lowest level of his presidency. Obama's oft-repeated assurance that if you like your health plan, you can keep it, also turns out not to be true for middle-class people who bought cheap policies on the individual market, and Obama apologizes. In Geneva, Iran and 6 major world powers, including the U.S., reach a deal to halt Iran's uranium enrichment for 6 months in return for a partial easing of economic sanctions, while negotiations for a permanent agreement take place. December. Nelson Mandela dies at the age of 95. President Obama eulogizes the former freedom fighter and South African president as one of the most influential, courageous, and profoundly good human beings that any of us will share time with on this earth. But Obama is criticized when photos emerge showing him taking a selfie with Danish Prime Minister Helle Thorning-Schmidt during the funeral, as Michelle Obama scowls in the background. After 2 months of frantic debugging, healthcare.gov is showing signs of life, with enrollments sharply up. Questions remain, however, over the website's back end, and whether those signing up will actually find themselves insured come January. A federal judge declares that NSA's vast surveillance of phone records unconstitutional and almost Orwellian. An independent review panel appointed by Obama essentially agrees, noting in its report, Americans must never make the mistake of wholly trusting our public officials. And that, my friends, is the week's take on the year in review. In the Health and Science Review for the year, they split it into several short pieces called Some of the Things They Said Were Good for Us, and some other short pieces, and some of the things we were told to avoid. We'll take a few from each of those pages this week and next week. So a few of the things they said were good for us. Video games keep older minds sharp. Researchers asked volunteers ages 60 to 85 to play a fast-paced video game that involved driving while identifying signs. Participants' skills were monitored at the outset, and after a month of playing three times a week, not only did their performance improve dramatically, but they also scored higher afterward on tests of short-term memory and long-term focus. The study shows you can take older people who aren't functioning well and make them cognitively younger through this training, said MIT neuroscientist Earl Miller. It's a very big deal. Group singing can create a rewarding feeling of oneness. Swedish researchers monitored the heart rates of 15 choral singers as they hummed, sang, and chanted. The singers' pulses increased and decreased together as the music's tempo changed, and their heartbeats aligned when the songs required them to breathe in unison. You are synchronizing with other people and harmonizing your hearts, says study author Bjorn Wyckoff. That could explain why singing together strengthened solidarity in groups from football fans to work crews. The controlled breathing that singing demands also seems to have a calming influence, achieving the same effect as breathing exercises in yoga. Pessimism can lead to a longer life. German researchers asked 40,000 people ages 18 to 96 to rate how happy they thought they'd be in 5 years on a scale of 0 to 10. Checking in 5 years later, they found that every point by which a person had overestimated his or her future well-being corresponded to a 10% higher likelihood of death or disability within the study period. Pessimism about the future may encourage people to live more carefully, taking health and safety precautions, says psychologist Frieder Lang. And now a few of the things we were told to avoid. Facebook can make you unhappy. Researchers texted study participants five times a day with questions about their social networking activity and how they felt, and found that Facebook visits directly correlated with negative emotions, such as depression and loneliness. While Facebook seems to fulfill the basic human need for social connection, says University of Michigan social psychologist Ethan Kross, it can actually undermine well-being. Researchers speculate that because Facebook users tend to post idealized versions of their lives, many visitors who read those pages feel their own lives pale in comparison. Time indoors can weaken your vision. A study found that 42% of people in the U.S. between the ages of 12 and 54 have nearsightedness or myopia, compared with 25% 40 years ago. Rates of the condition also seem to be rising only among urban kids, as opposed to rural children who spend more time outdoors. Myopia previously was thought to be largely hereditary, but the gene pool can't change that much in a generation, says Ian Morgan of Australian National University. Researchers believe that too much time looking at books and computer screens without looking farther away is damaging vision. Marrying the wrong person can increase your risk of major depression. Researchers asked more than 4,500 people between the ages of 20 and 80 to rate how supportive or critical their spouses were of them, and then followed up a decade later. Participants were asked whether their spouses could be relied on for help with a serious problem, and how well their partners understood them. People with the most negative relationships were found to be more than twice as likely to become severely depressed over the study period as people with the most positive unions. As mentioned in the note to readers at the beginning of this program, this year-end issue has three longer reads, the type of article we usually hear in the last word section. Here they call them great reads from 2013. We'll pick up one of them this week and see if we can get to the other two next week. You'll never know it's gone. Apollo Robbins will tell you he's going to pick your pocket, said Adam Green, but you still won't notice. A few years ago, at a Las Vegas convention for magicians, Penn Jillette of the act Penn and Teller was introduced to a soft-spoken young man named Apollo Robbins, who has a reputation as a pickpocket of almost supernatural ability. Jillette, who ranks pickpockets, he says, a few notches below hypnotist on the showbiz totem pole, was holding court at a table of colleagues, and he asked Robbins for a demonstration, ready to be unimpressed. Robbins demurred, claiming that he felt uncomfortable working in front of other magicians. He pointed out that since Jillette was wearing only shorts and a sports shirt, he wouldn't have much to work with. "Come on," Jillette said, "steal something from me." Again, Robbins begged off, but he offered to do a trick instead. He instructed Jillette to place a ring that he was wearing on a piece of paper and trace its outline with a pen. By now, a small crowd had gathered. Jillette removed his ring, put it down on the paper, unclipped a pen from his shirt, and leaned forward, preparing to draw. After a moment, he froze and looked up. His face was pale. "F you," he said, and slumped into a chair. Robbins held up a thin cylindrical object, the cartridge from Jillette's pen. Robbins, who is 38 and lives in Las Vegas, is a peculiar variety arts hybrid, known in the trade as a theatrical pickpocket. Among his peers, he is widely considered the best in the world at what he does, which is taking things from people's jackets, pants, purses, wrist, fingers, and necks, then returning them in amusing and mind-boggling ways. Robbins works smoothly and invisibly, with a different, diffident charm that belies his talent for larceny. One senses that he would prosper on the other side of the law. "You have to ask yourself one question," he often says as he holds up a wallet or a watch that he has just swiped. "Am I being paid enough to give it back?" In more than a decade as a full-time entertainer, Robbins has taken and returned a lot of stuff, including items from well-known figures in the world of entertainment: Jennifer Garner, actress, engagement ring; sports, Charles Barkley, former NBA star, wad of cash; and business, Ace Greenberg, former chairman of Bear Stearns, Patek Philippe watch. He is probably best known for an encounter with Jimmy Carter's Secret Service detail in 2001. While Carter was at dinner, Robbins struck up a conversation with several of his Secret Service men. Within a few minutes, he had emptied the agents' pockets of pretty much everything but their guns. Robbins brandished a copy of Carter's itinerary, and when an agent snatched it back, he said, "You don't have the authorization to see that." When the agent felt for his badge, Robbins produced it and handed it back. Then he turned to the head of the detail and handed him his watch, his badge, and the keys to the Carter motorcade. I first met Robbins in Las Vegas, and he took me to a walk-around corporate gig at the Rio Hotel and Casino. Despite the heat, he was dressed in black, jacket, shirt, tie, pants, and loafers. "It's kind of my signature," he told me, and explained that, were he to become a real pickpocket, he would dress more upscale to blend in at Las Vegas night spots. Robbins is short and compact, and he has the wiry physique of an acrobat beneath the softness of a few extra pounds. At the Rio, Robbins took in the scene with an appraising gaze of a jeweler. A few dozen middle-aged men and women, a group of advertising sales representatives and their clients, were drinking and eating shrimp on a patio in the late afternoon sun. Robbins had been told that they would be dressed in business casual. Most of the women had on colorful low-cut tops, tight white pants, and mules. Only a few of the men wore jackets. "This is going to be interesting," Robbins said. "Okay, time to go shopping." Robbins strolled through the crowd, smiling and nodding, resting a hand on a shoulder here, lightly touching an elbow there. From time to time, he let his fingertips graze somebody's pocket, a technique called fanning. "He's got a cell phone, keys, and maybe some cash in that right front pocket," Robbins whispered to me, indicating one man. "What I'm doing is taking inventory and making site maps and getting a feel for who these people are and what I'm going to do with them." By the time he finished his circuit of the patio, his manner had changed. He was more animated and playful, his movements graceful, almost stylized. Later he told me that he uses his pre-show scouting missions to segue into his thief persona. "Normally, when I'm not performing or stealing, I second-guess myself. I have doubts," he said. "But when I get into that mode, I'm invincible." Robbins began by striking up a conversation with a pair of sales executives named Suzanne and Josh. "What do you do?" Suzanne asked. "I specialize in future used goods, goods that used to belong to you. I'm a pickpocket." Josh and Suzanne chuckled nervously. "Don't worry, I give everything back. It's one of the conditions of my parole. Now, you said your name was Josh." "That's right." "I believe you, Josh. Would you come stand right here next to me?" Robbins guided Josh by the elbow to stand on his right, and, as a few other people gathered to watch, he put his arm around him. "Don't be nervous," Robbins went on. "I'm not actually going to put my hand in your pocket. I'm not ready for that kind of commitment." "That's because, at my last show, a guy had a hole in his pocket, and that was rather traumatizing to me." Robbins cocked his left eyebrow and produced a silver dollar from his pocket. "Now, I'm going to give you this silver coin to hold on to, and we'll see if I can steal it back." Robbins positioned Josh's left hand at shoulder level, palm up. "Okay, I put this in your hand, and you close it. Would you be impressed if I could take it out of your hand? Say yes." "Yes." "So would I. Okay, open your hand." Josh opened his hand, and Robbins snatched the coin from his palm and said, "Thank you very much," he smiled. "Okay, one more time." Robbins closed the coin in his own hand and had Josh grab his wrist. When he opened his hand, the coin was gone. Josh laughed. "The coin's not in my hand. It couldn't be. You know why? It's on your left shoulder." Josh grew increasingly befuddled as Robbins continued to make the coin vanish and reappear. On his shoulder, in his pocket, under his watch band. In the middle of this, Robbins started stealing Josh's stuff. Josh's watch seemed to melt off his wrist, and Robbins held it up behind his back for everyone to see. Then he took Josh's wallet, his sunglasses, and his phone. Robbins dances around his victims, gently guiding them into place, floating in and out of their personal space. By the time they comprehend what has happened, Robbins is waiting with a look that says, "I understand what you must be feeling." Robbins' simplest improvisations have the dreamlike quality of a casual encounter gone subtly awry. He struck up a conversation with a young man who told him, "We're going to Penn and Teller after this." "Oh, then you'll probably want these," Robbins said, handing over a pair of tickets that had recently been in the young man's wallet. Robbins needs to get close to his victims without setting off alarm bells. "If I come at you head on like this," he said, stepping forward, "I'm going to run into that bubble of your personal space very quickly, and that's going to make you uncomfortable." He took a step back. "So what I do is give you a point of focus, say a coin. Then I break eye contact by looking down, and I pivot around the point of focus, stepping forward in an arc or a semicircle till I'm in your space." He demonstrated, winding up shoulder to shoulder with me, looking at me sideways, his head cocked, all innocence. "See how I was able to close the gap?" he said. "I flew in under your radar, and I have access to all your pockets." Robbins has been approached by the Department of Defense to consult on the military applications of pickpocketing, behavioral influence, and con games. The DOD has just endowed a new research and training facility at Yale. Robbins is to be an adjunct professor there and will give lectures and design training modules. The defense application of Robbins' work is less strange than it might at first seem. Barton Whaley and Susan Stratton Askroyd's textbook of military counter-deception, published in 2007, notes that in the 1970s, conjurers had evolved theories and principles of deception and counter-deception that were substantially more advanced than currently used by political or military intelligence analysts. "I spoke to the Special Operations Command official who had recruited Robbins for the project, and he told me that Robbins had been brought to his attention by some of his men, who had been impressed by videos of him on YouTube. It's no big secret that a lot of Army Special Forces guys have a very big interest in magic and deception and being able to manipulate attention," he said. "Apollo is the guy who actually gets into the nuts and bolts of how it works, why it works, and oftentimes can extrapolate that into the bigger principle." Robbins' work has also been noticed by neuroscientists. A couple of years ago, he caused a stir at the annual convention of the Association for Scientific Study of Consciousness, explaining his theories of attention management and deconstructing his coin-on-the-shoulder routine. The co-chairs of that year's conference, Stephen Macnick and Susanna Martinez-Conde, a husband and wife team of neuroscientists, subsequently started working with Robbins and collaborated on a book, Sleights of Mind, which relates some of Robbins' techniques to aspects of cognition. The intersection of magic and neuroscience has become a topic of some interest in the scientific community, and Robbins is now a regular on the lecture circuit. Recently, at a forum in Baltimore, he shared a stage with the psychologist Daniel Kahneman, who won a Nobel Prize for his work in behavioral economics, and the two had a long discussion about so-called inattentional blindness, the phenomenon of focusing so intently on a single task that one fails to notice things in plain sight. Many of Robbins' neuroscience talks find their ways onto YouTube, and I asked him if he were concerned that he might be giving too much away. "It doesn't matter if people are aware of how I work or even what I'm going to do," he said. "They still won't catch it. While they're trying to watch for it, I'll be watching them." This was copyrighted in 2013 by Adam Green and was taken from a longer article that originally appeared in The New Yorker. We'll take in a couple of the book reviews. They're calling this Critics' Choice, the best of 2013, and they break it into fiction and nonfiction. I'll read the number one from each category. The number one fiction, 10th of December by George Saunders. George Saunders has just cemented his standing as the quintessential writer of our time, said Ellen Akins in the Minneapolis Star Tribune. His short stories take the empty language of so much of our daily discourse, from business jargon to self-help bromides, and show us how it's capable of being used to express the fullness of our souls. In the collection's 10 stories, this arch observer plunges us into the inner monologues of a host of characters, some despairing, some self-centered, but all inescapably human. The book has a sneaky coherence, said David L. Ulan in the Los Angeles Times. Whether we're reading about a man who's purchased immigrants to serve as lawn ornaments, or about a prisoner who is fed mood-altering pills, the author wants us to see each character struggling to transcend personal limitations. At its best, the book achieves a vivid synergy between the ridiculous culture we have built for ourselves and the heartbreak and longing of our inner lives. And they include a dissenting comment. Too many of Saunders' men speak in the same voice, slightly too literal and slightly childish, said David Wolfe in The Observer. And the number one critic's choice for nonfiction is titled Going Clear by Lawrence Wright. That's W-R-I-G-H-T. Truth can be stranger than even science fiction, said Lisa Miller in The Washington Post. Expanding on his widely read 2011 New Yorker feature about a Scientology apostate, Lawrence Wright brought a clear-eyed, investigative fearlessness to the task of taking a full measure of the secretive global church founded in 1954 by pulp novelist L. Ron Hubbard. In Wright's deeply researched account, current leader David Miscavige comes across as a violent authoritarian, and its prominent adherent, Tom Cruise, as a monstrous narcissist. But Going Clear captures Scientology's seductive glamour as well, said Nathan Rabin in the AV Club. Wright acknowledges the appeal of the faith's sci-fi tenets and shows how the organization offers recruits, Hollywood stars and impoverished trailer dwellers alike, a sense of community and purpose. Mostly, though, Wright abhors what he sees, turning his findings into a ripping yarn about ego, money, abuse, faith, and the corrupting nature of power. And a dissenting comment on this one, Wright plunges in so deep, he sometimes doesn't realize when he's left the reader behind, said Michael Kinsley in the New York Times. Here are a couple of the biggest business stories of 2013. The taper finally arrives. For most of the year, all eyes were on the Federal Reserve, as investors and economists waited for the central bank to pull back from its controversial $85 billion a month bond buying program. The easy money policy, known as quantitative easing, has been unpopular with fiscal hawks, who worry it could lead to big losses for the central bank if interest rates rise, and to out-of-control inflation once the economy picks up speed. Yet for much of the year, Wall Street fretted that markets would suffer withdrawal when the Fed stopped administering the financial world equivalent of a performance-enhancing drug, said Adam Schell in USA Today. The question of how and when the latest round of quantitative easing, the third since 2008, would end arose in earnest at the Fed's May 21st meeting, when Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke signaled that the central bank might scale it back when unemployment dropped below 7%. With the so-called taper explicitly tied to unemployment, investors adopted a laser-like focus on the Labor Department's monthly jobs data. The Fed was widely expected to start tapering off in September, but officials surprised investors by holding off in the face of tepid economic data. Yet many were equally surprised in mid-December when the Fed responded to a marked improvement in the economy by announcing that it would reduce its monthly bond buying slightly to $75 billion a month. The taper had begun, but so gingerly that the markets and the dollar rose in response. The Fed also had a change in leadership. Vice Chairwoman Janet Yellen was named as the Obama administration's choice to succeed Bernanke as chairman of the central bank. Many had predicted that Obama would choose Lawrence Summers, a former Treasury Secretary in Clinton's White House and director of Obama's National Economic Council. But he was strongly opposed by the liberal Democrats, who criticized his role in Clinton-era financial deregulation and his reputation for arrogance. They also complained that Obama had a poor track record of appointing women. Faced with what he said would have been an acrimonious confirmation process, Summers withdrew. The Senate was expected to confirm Yellen in January. 2013's bullish stock bonanza. This year's stock market proved that the death of equities has been greatly exaggerated, said Steven Perlberg in BusinessInsider.com. The market soared to unprecedented heights, hitting new records week after week. Encouraged by the Federal Reserve's bond buying program, investors poured cash into stocks, sending the S&P 500 soaring above 1,800 for the first time ever, while the Dow Jones Industrial Average surpassed 16,000, another all-time high. More bearish investors, some of them perhaps seeking to justify having missed significant gains by staying out of the market, saw the zooming prices as an augur of an impending crash, and some experts confirmed those fears. "I am most worried about the boom in the U.S. stock market," said Yale economist Robert Shiller. "Our economy is still weak and vulnerable." In fact, the economy was something of a mixed bag. The housing market heated up and car sales consistently hit high numbers, but federal spending cuts, higher income taxes, and a partial government shutdown were all seen as drags on growth and output. And while the unemployment rate hit a five-year low of 7%, the labor market wasn't all good news. Many worried that employers were hiring too many part-timers rather than full-time workers, and pointed out that the unemployment rate's fall was largely a reflection of more and more retirees and unemployed workers simply giving up on finding jobs and leaving the labor market altogether. Still, by year's end, most signs pointed to a period of more robust growth, with economists predicting the economy will expand by an average of 2.6% in 2014. Twitter's public market debut. Twitter's spectacular entry on the New York Stock Exchange in November suggested that these days, innovative ideas are more valuable than physical assets or existing cash flow, said Larry Popelka in BusinessWeek.com. Twitter has no profits, yet its stock surged 73% above its initial valuation of $26 on the first day. The $2.1 billion initial public offering was the second largest market debut for an internet company ever, behind Facebook's $16 billion IPO in 2012. The microblogging site's listing on the New York Stock Exchange was a blow for rival NASDAQ, which had to pay millions in compensation after technical glitches delayed Facebook's IPO. Despite a few temporary flutters, Twitter's stock has continued to rise in the weeks since its market launch, reaching share prices more than double its initial valuation. Buyers have been encouraged by Twitter's pre-IPO claim of an active user base of 232 million, up 39% from September 2012, and by its improving prospects as an advertising medium. Some investors had doubts. Twitter expected 2013 revenue of $638 million, yet it lost $134 million in the first three quarters of the year alone. Facebook, in comparison, had more than $2 billion in revenue and $425 million in income just in the third quarter. But Twitter buyers were unfazed. "I want my family to love me the way the market loves Twitter," said CNBC stock analyst Jim Cramer. "It's the kind of unconditional love that means you never have to say you're sorry." On the poll watch, the way we were in 2013, the week has taken a group of their polls that they put in each week and grouped them into categories. So is this from the category, "How are we feeling?" Pretty glum. In November, 70% of Americans said the country was on the wrong track, the highest number in 2 years. And 42% expect the economy to get worse in the next 12 months. 54% say they've felt little or no economic improvement since the 2008 financial crisis. And 29% think the economy will never fully recover. That sense of pessimism extends overseas. 70% say the U.S. is losing respect international. And 53% believe America plays a less important role in the world than a decade ago. 52% say the U.S. should mind its own business and try to stay out of other nations' affairs. The next category, who do we blame for America's problems? Politicians. 59% of voters disapprove of President Obama's handling of the economy, and 60% don't like how he's dealt with health care. Even young Americans are souring on the president, with 54% of 18 to 29-year-olds saying they're unhappy with his performance. Voters aren't frustrated with Obama alone. Only 9% approve of the way Congress is doing its job, the lowest number in 39 years. And 60% would like to replace every single senator and representative. To get better politicians, though, we may need better voters. 55% say most Americans are guided by their emotions, not facts, when they vote. How has society changed? We're more open-minded. A record 63% say it is morally acceptable for unmarried people to have sex. 59% have no moral objections to gay relationships. And for the first time, a majority of Americans, 58%, favor legalizing marijuana. But we're troubled by technology's effect on the nation. 59% say the internet and social media are making Americans ruder. And 69% think we're too distracted by our gadgets. Evidence suggests they're right. 49% of adults and 43% of teenagers admit to texting while driving, even though they know it's unsafe. 33% of smartphone owners say they've used their device during a dinner date. 9% admit to looking at their phones during sex. How do we relax? We watch a lot of sports. Pro football is by far America's favorite sport, with 48% of sports fans saying they closely follow events on the gridiron, compared with 11% who are devoted to pro basketball and 7% to Major League Baseball. 84% of football fans say their viewing pleasure hasn't been affected by growing scientific evidence that hard hits can leave players permanently brain damaged. What are we scared of? A lot. 66% worry about a terrorist attack on their community. And 55% fear that a mass shooting might happen in their area. For many, Washington is what keeps them up nights. 53% think the government threatens their personal rights and freedoms, while 36% of Americans, including 62% of Republicans, suspect the Obama administration is secretly plotting to seize everyone's guns. Despite our fear of the feds, 56% approve of drone aircraft being used to kill suspected foreign terrorists on U.S. soil. But there are limits to the powers we're preparing to grant these flying robots. An overwhelming 72% oppose using drones to monitor motorists and issue speeding tickets. And a quote from Nancy Mitford. The great advantage of living in a large family is that early lesson of life's essential unfairness. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time where we'll return to this year-end review. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after this at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and again, Happy New Year.